The talk is Predictability, Complexity, and Learning. Three authors in the alphabetical order. William Bialik, who was actually the first one who started to work on this subject, I think in 92. Then in 94, Talit Yuzbek has joined him. And in 97, I joined two of them to work on the same subject. And this is actually a big part of my thesis at Princeton. So there are four preprints available on the website on this and slightly related topics. They're all in various stages of being published. So the quick outline of this talk, first I'll start with one curious observation which will sort of hopefully motivate both me and the audience why we should look at these things and what questions should we ask about predictability, complexity, and learning not as a three independent things but as a one thing together. So after viewing these examples, this curious observation, we can actually formulate the objectives of what we want to do, how are these three things together different from each of these three things separately. Should we use information theory and how? When then is the sickest point if I give this a similar talk to information theory or computer science audience? Should we use notion of ensembles? Should we average or take prediction and learning from one particular string? So I'll spend a few slides on this. Then we'll define what we mean by predictive information and discuss how it behaves in different regimes. Show that predictive information provides a unique measure of complexity, and if we have time, I'll discuss possible applications. Some of them are already applied, some of them are still in the stage of being worked on. So the observations, curious observation. Suppose we have a chain of spins. So as an example here, I showed a spin of 17 chains, some of them down, which we call 0, some of them up, which we call 1. Suppose I'm in, let's just try to empirically calculate the following quantity. The entropy of all possible words of length n, in the example here I took n equal to 4, which occur in this chain. So if n is equal to 4, there are 16 possible words. The first one 0, 0, 0, 0, the last, the 15th one is 1, 1, 1, 1. Some of them occur 2 times in the chain, some of them occur 3 times, none of them occur 3 times, some of them occur once, some of them do not occur in the chain. So this is the word 0, 0, 0, right, here it is, then it happens once again over here, the word 9, here it is, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, happens only once in the chain, and similarly some of the words do not happen at all. So this can gives us frequencies of events. We associate frequencies with probabilities. We calculate empirical entropy of these words of length 4, and it happens that it's, for this example, is 2.95 bits, which is less than 4 bits, showing that the sequence is not entirely a random sequence. Okay, so now let's do this exactly the same procedure for three different spin chains, generated with totally computer simulated with three different rules. The first spin chain is a nearest neighbor interaction. At some temperature equal to 1, delta I interactions are scaled to this temperature, and we just do exactly the same procedure. For the second case, again, this is nearest neighbor interactions, but the coupling constant is actually taken at random from some Gaussian distribution centered at 0, variance 1. So basically what happens is that we pick a coupling constant, generate 400,000 spins with this coupling constant, then we reset the coupling constant at random from this distribution. So it's sort of, we can do it not in this hard way resetting, but we can do a continuous variation of a coupling constant or random variation of a coupling constant. The result is going to be the same. The point is that there is one coupling constant and it gets reset. Finally, the third example is we have not one, but many. The simulations I took, I think, over 200 coupling constants. So this is not a nearest neighbor interaction. Spin I interacts with a spin j, but the scale of interactions falls off with the distance. And again, every 400 spins, we reset all of these interactions. So we generate three spin chains. Each of them is 1 billion spins long. Do the same procedure I described on the previous page, and plot the...
Are you relaxing this equilibrium? You choose a coupling constant.
I choose a comp. I generate it at equilibrium. Basically, this is a spin chain, so you can generate it as a Markov process. So the next spin depends only on previous spins, and then the third spin depends on the second, the fourth on the third. So I always generate a sequence, a system at equilibrium, unless there is going to be some atypical realization.
So the future spins only depend on the.
On the previous ones, yeah, but I mean you can generate it because we are not at the phase and at the critical point. This is the boundary effects, which is whether the spin is I mean the chain is round or just a long chain. They do not matter, and then you can generate it for either from left or from right. Doesn't really matter, and they always throw away a few hundred spins in the beginning and in the end due to equilibrium, you know, just to make sure that the system equilibrates. That's it. So it's actually a very simple procedure.
It's not obvious to me that this is a typical configuration at a given temperature. Is that the claim that it's
a typical configuration?
Because configuration.
It's going to be a typical configuration. For some temperature. And really, I don't care what the temperature is.
Right, the temperature presumably depends on the distribution.
So what's important?
But you can show that it is a typical.
It's going to be a typical. We'll come to this point in a few seconds. Slightly different. No, I'm not, because I think this is not. I'm going to again mention this.
Simulation where I took a chain.
Right.
I asked the same question. I took a chain and I relaxed it just using some Clauber dynamics. So locally, we're just kind of finitely, and then I compared it to doing this. Markov chain.
Right.
Different results for the correlation.
So depending on in the first two cases there's not going to be any problems. In the third case you can have long range interactions, and then in this case yes, you will have to basically it would mean that you have correlation length is infinite, and then you will have to take care of that of these effects. So but if this were true, it would even emphasize my point for the third case even more. So actually, what I'm saying is that I do not care about this effects. This is just one chain which I generated, and I'm just analyzing this particular chain. Okay, so it's not a main point. Just stay with me for a second. So I generated this chain, calculated the entropy as a function of the length of the word 1 to up to 26, because that's how much memory I have on my machine, and plotted on this graph, and you immediately see that there is just no difference in principle between these three cases, right? This is the case for the first, the upper one is the case for the third, and then the middle one is the case, I think, for the third one, right? So they're not even happen to be in the same order as they were here, right? So there is nothing to distinguish. I mean, there is no way to distinguish between these three chains using this graph. However,
Everything you say only applies to infinitely long chains or for finite chains as well.
So here we have a 1 billion long chain.
But what about for a short string? That's what you say.
You will have to take into account averaging over chains.
Okay.
That's exactly actually what we do here. If you see 400 spins and then average over 2,000 and 2,500 different chains, so that's what actually happens.
Okay.
You say there is no distinction.
Exactly. Fine. So that's what I'm going to show on the next slide. So it's very easy on the computer to fit a straight line to this. So you fit a straight line, subtract straight line from this stuff, and that's what you get. This is the first case, the second case, the third case. Here it's a clear constant, clear logarithm, clear square root. Right. So this is the fixed interactions. These are fixed interactions, but averaging over all possible interactions. And this is long-range interaction averaging over all possible interactions. So you have three different behaviors. And the extensive part of the entropy does not allow to make a distinction between these three cases. In physics, unless we are in this, right?
The absolute value of the extensive value.
What do you mean absolute value?
The factor. Proportional to n.
Yes.
If this goes in the right direction, that if you have disorder in the coupling, it's higher entropy. And
no, it doesn't go in this way.
No?
If you actually look on the. Sorry.
If you have long range interaction.
So this is. Log range interaction is here, right? So this long-range interaction, I mean, actually how I generated the spins, what happens with this, the width of this eta, it actually happens to be that this chain is also disordered. Right.
So the long-range interaction with respect to the upper curve,
right,
introducing long-range interactions brings down the amplification.
Right, but how about this case?
Because you put disorder, in case two. With
respect to case one. Okay, so I'll put JIJ 2 here, so I'll get to take it at a different temperature. I'll completely change the slope because entropy changes with the temperature, and that's it. I immediately change this order. I can play with the temperatures and get different orders. Basically, that's
so
what I'm saying.
Then you make a strong claim that the absolute value has no meaning?
No, I'm not making this claim. The absolute value has meaning. It just doesn't have meaning if you want to make a distinction between these three cases. The absolute value of entropy is the entropy density in physics. It's also the channel capacity in information theory. It's a very important thing. However, what I'm saying is that if you want to make a distinction between these three cases, and you talk about the channel capacity or entropy density, then you just won't be able to make any kind of distinction.
In the sense that it's always linear,
yeah. It's linear enough. That's it. But there's not much more to that. But the subextensive pieces are very different for these three cases. So if you throw away the extensive part, you will be immediately able to distinguish these three pieces, and what's actually the most important, distinguish them in the correct order. The simplest case, which is the no averaging, just constant interactions, comes as the slowest growing. Then the second case, where you have just one coupling constant, is the second fastest growing. And then when you have many coupling constants, is the fastest growing. Actually, if you do the same stuff, not on spin chains, but on other sequences that happen in nature, which is, let's say, periodic sequence, what you do is take a logistic map when it's periodic and do the same stuff, or you take the same logistic map when it's chaotic, so above a Feigenbaum point, and you get the same behavior. It's still a constant. It doesn't matter whether it's very easy to predict in the sense that you can, by knowing one sequence, one symbol, you know everything else that's coming after it, or if you just cannot predict it at all, you always get the same constant behavior. And these both regimes are finite correlation lengths, right?
It would help me if mm-hmm. you focus things a little bit.
Yeah.
If you can say in words what S of N means. Do I mean it like this? Suppose you give me a text in some language, and
right.
I imagine this language is made of 10-letter words, and then I compute S of 10.
Right.
And I imagine the language is made of 2-letter words.
And you compute S of 2, right.
And if I calculate S of 10, I find that it's more random. There's less structure, but if I calculate S of 2, then I find it...
Actually, no. It's the other way around. So the S of 10 is going to be less... More structured than you expected it to be.
The entropy is higher.
The entropy is higher, but the structure is lower. And that's the point. So the entropy increases,
right,
but the structure actually falls off. So there is no one-to-one correspondence between entropy and structure.
Right.
So what you actually want to do is you want to measure structure independently of entropy. And what our claim is going to be is that the only stuff that you have to do for that is to throw away the extensive part of the entropy, and what you're going to be left with is exactly the structure.
Uh-huh.
That's our claim.
What do you mean by structure is that?
We'll get to it. I'll try to define it axiomatically, actually.
See, I'm still confused, because if I were to compare, say, a language like English versus German, and say...
Somebody did this.
Say German, on the average, the German words are longer on the average.
Mm-hmm.
So there must be some characteristic end of the language.
So what happens in English and in German language, some guy did it about 20 years ago, and then people did it also for other alphabetical languages. What happens is that the extensive part, which is
uh-huh.
the entropy density, is
right.
Totally different.
Extensive part.
Totally different. However, the subextensive part is the same. So you get for English and for German,
mm-hmm.
you get the exponent here, 0.5 plus or minus 0.06, I think, something like that. That's what the most common estimate, meaning that the structure in the language
the correlation in language is the same.
Is the same, right? So meaning that this language can produce is the same. However, the local structure of the languages is very different, right? But you can always translate from English to German without losing any meaning, without losing any global structure which spans the text.
But to come back to his question,
right,
which slope would be higher?
In German or in English?
The extensive part.
I cannot really remember. I think it's in English. I think in English it's higher, but I don't remember. I know where to look it up, but I don't remember. I think it's in English.
I don't have an intuition for this quantity, so it's difficult. Okay,
but
I'll go on.
So it just SFN measures disorder in N symbols.
Okay.
That's what it is. It's measure of disorder. How disordered are letters of 10 bits, I mean, of 10 words of 10 letters are. Mm-hmm. That's what it measures. It's just that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the subaccessive part is telling us something about temporal correlations?
Yes, but but you should not confuse this. These are not only two-point correlations. Two-point correlations, again, and this is the thing which I'm trying to...
Two-point
to,
correlations would be reflected in the extensive entropy, right?
No. Not necessarily, because if correlation length for two-point correlation diverges, right, you can still get a finite entropy, extensive entropy, but you will get a logarithmic piece. If it does not diverge, you get a constant piece. However, if three-point higher point correlation functions cannot be written as just simple products of two-point correlation functions, then you will may be able to get a parallel behavior. So just the number of independent things, the number of independent correlation functions, that's what matters. That's what this quantity, the number of divergent independent correlation functions, that sort of colloquially, that's what this stuff measures. And again, just continuing this, if you, for example, look at a system at a phase transition point, or at, let's say, at a logistic map at the onset of house at Feigenbaum point, you get logarithmic growth here. If you look at natural texts, if you look at DNA sequences, and possibly at some phase transitions here, we're not quite sure, you get power loss, not necessarily 0.5. For DNAs, for different, actually, species, you get anywhere from 0.1 to 0.8 or something like that. But this is, people have done this kind of analysis. And the take-home message from this slide is that entropy density, or what's called also channel capacity, does not distinguish these three cases. You can always construct the same randomness while having different subextensive components. And this is what the channel capacity measures. It measures randomness. You may have the same randomness but different structure, right? Similarly, the serial phase transitions, at least what it's told in normal textbooks, which you only focus on two-point correlation function and two-point correlation lengths, does not distinguish between this case and this case. In both cases, two-point correlation lengths is divergent, but you don't. But these are clearly two different cases. And
if you think about the normalization group thinks about the probability distribution, and so I think if you look at submedian corrections to scaling, etc.,
yes. So if you look at finite size effects, we have been able to get relations between the coefficients, various coefficients that happen in finite size scaling, and the constant is in front of this log or the power, or this power. Yes, if you look at finite size effects, you can do this. And we've done it for long chain, one-dimensional chain, and we always focus on one dimensions. It will become a bit clear why later. So it's one-dimensional chain with long-range interactions, which can have phase transition, right? So.
Yeah, maybe a late question, but you don't have the fourth case where you have long-range interactions, but with a fixed coupling.
You will still get the same stuff.
Like, okay.
Just like here. So, and so this actually brings me to the point which I forgot to mention on the slides. So another intuition which you should have, which you may have, and which will actually explain why you can bring learning and predictability and complexity all together using these ideas, is that in the first case, you know, what you can imagine is that you've observed some spins up to now, and now you're trying to predict what the next spin is going to be, meaning that you are trying to learn what is the underlying statistics for the distribution of the spins, what is the underlying distribution. And in the first case, there is nothing to learn. The whole distribution is known to start with. So there is nothing to learn, you get a constant. In the second case, you have one parameter to learn, because you don't know in what place in the sequence you are in, you don't know what the random coupling is, you have one parameter to learn, and you get one half log n. In the third case, the longer you observe, you become sensitive to longer and longer interactions, longer and longer range interactions. So not only you can learn the same couplings in better detail, but you can learn more couplings if you observe longer times. And you get a power law. And the relation between how the number of couplings you can learn, grows as a function of the observed sequence, actually defines the exponent of this power law. You'll see it in a minute. So, what are our objectives here? Again, we want to build a unified description of learning. Unified in the sense that it does not depend on the metric which we choose to describe learning. So, we don't predefine learning curves to start with. It doesn't depend on the algorithm. It's a neural network, support vector machine, Bayesian, whatever. It doesn't really matter. We want a unified picture of learning. Similarly, we want a unified picture of complexity, which would sort of intuitively tell us that the more rules you have to describe complexity, the more complex, describe the source, the more complex the source is. We want to count rules in some sense. We want to make distinction between noise and signal. Again, if you looked in this constant interaction chain, you have, you know, 1 billion spins, which is you have a lot of information, but none of that is usable to make predictions, right? It's all random. None of it is usable to make prediction. So we want to make a distinction between something which is usable and not usable, something which is noise and something which is signal. And finally, we want all of these things to be together. So these are 4 points which we want to make. And so the solution of this, and this is sort of the insight that Bill had in 92 or 91, is that what you can do this with is the notion of predictability, which I'm going to quantify in the next slide. Why is it helpful? Well, for the learning case, in any case, whatever you're learning is an estimation of parameters, extrapolation, anything, just name your type of learning, you do not learn in order to find the parameters. You learn in order to generalize from the data. You learn in order to be able to make predictions about the next data points that are going to come. So prediction enters here, right? Usability. Well, we learn, I mean, we get the data points now, but if we're an animal, we're going, you know, we have reaction time. It takes us a few seconds or milliseconds to react on the data we achieved. So each data which is not capable of giving any kind of information about the future, which is not possible to be used for generalization, prediction, is just useless. So this is a very easy distinction between noise and signal. If you can use it to make predictions, it's signal. If you cannot, it's noise. For complexity, again, if the source is highly predictable in the sense that you need to a lot of data to make predictions about the source, it's more complex. And obviously, this all stuff is related. I mean, I'm just saying the same thing in different words, right? So how do you quantify predictability? We said we wanted to do it in a non-metric way. So we do not define what the learning curve is going to be to start with. The only known to us way which defines learning or any kind of stuff related to learning in a non-metric way is an information theory designed by Shannon in the 40s and 50s. So basically, if we have a signal which depends on X or T or that whatever, and signal maybe is a continuous or discrete. If it's continuous, then we've observed the past, which is of length T. If it's discrete, we've observed the past, which is of N instances, right? Now we have a future in front of us, which is of length T prime or N prime. And the predictability is the only way to do it with information theory is the mutual information between past and future. How much information does the past provide you about the future? That's what we want to calculate. That's the quantity that we're going to calculate. So you write this quantity down, information between past and future, just rewrite it in a very straightforward way, which is entropy of...
What's the average over?
average of a probability distribution of past and futures, and I'll get probability distribution of past and futures, and I'll get.
You mean the joint distribution?
Joint distribution of past and futures.
If the past and the future both occur.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a joint probability distribution of past and future.
This joint distribution,
not the product. It's a joint distribution of past and future. And I'll get to the question about, you know, where do we get this joint distribution in a second. And so you expand this in a very straightforward way, and you get entropy of the past, which is of time t, entropy of the future, which is of time t prime, minus entropy of past, it should be comma future. But if the signal is stationary, and we're going to make this assumption, then it's actually the entropy of past and future combined, just the duration of the signal, past and future. Now, we remember that entropy is extensive quantity, right? So we write S of t as S naught multiplied by t plus sub-extensive corrections. Plug this into this formula, and we see that all of the extensivity just vanishes. So if you are able to make predictions after observing past, it's only because the signal is, the entropy of the signal is subextensive, has subextensive components. If it does not have subextensive component, you have no ability to make predictions between past and future. Also, it makes sense to define a slightly different version of this predictive information, this quantity we call predictive information, which is the amount of information that finite past t tells us about infinite future. So we observed for t, and we care about all of the future that lies ahead. This is now a function of just one variable, and it's a two-line calculation to show that this is exactly equal to S1 of t. So from now on,
assume S1 of infinity is 0, right?
I assume that S1 of infinity plus t is the same as S1 of infinity. That's what I assume.
Oh, yeah. S1 of t plus is equal to S1 of t
plus infinity, right?
Yeah, well, S1 if you add infinity, it doesn't change. So, it is a smaller correction. For example, S1 of t could go like log t. Right?
I think I lost you at some point. If you add t, it doesn't change. If you add
you add t to infinity, it doesn't
change.
If S1 you add one of infinity is equal to S1
one of infinity plus t. Right. That's what happens.
Okay.
Up to first order, right, of course. So these two points are exactly the same. So from now on, I may talk about subextensive entropy or predictive information. I mean exactly the same thing. You shouldn't get confused. So what are the quantities of this predictive? What are the properties of this predictive information? Well, first of all, it's information. So it's always positive or zero. Second, it's subextensive. And this immediately leads us to the third thing, that, you know, the total amount of information that you gather, S of t, is extensive. And since predictive information is subextensive, the ratio of the two goes to zero when observation time is large. We call this the law of diminishing returns. Basically, the longer you observe, the less useful information you are able to get from the source. And Bill has joked that, well, after a few years, you should probably change your field. Otherwise, you know, the returns diminish. The other thing is that predictive information, being a mutual information, is actually not information that past provides about the future, but it's actually information shared between past and future. It's symmetric between past and future, meaning that prediction postdiction is exactly the same problem. So it's in the sense that it's as difficult to make predictions into the future as it is to try to reconstruct events in the past which you don't know about.
But this has to do with your assumption of stationarity.
This has to do with the assumption of stationarity, absolutely. Finally, we wanted a unifying theory, right? And you have to believe me, and I'll have to skip this part, that all 24 definitions of complexity, which I've gathered, you know, preparing for my thesis, and over also 24 different learning curves people define in learning community, all of them are either this predictive information, or its part, or its derivative, or its integral, or anything like that. They all relate to this quantity. So now we get to a big question, this notion of ensembles, right? So when I look at the stream of data, I have just one stream, just one sequence. So why I'm talking about averaging over all possible strings when I'm, you know, talking about learning or talking about complexity? This is the argument which, of course, didn't ever happen because people lived in different times. between what's called Kolmogorov complexity and Grasberger definition of complexity. So Kolmogorov complexity or Kolmogorov approach is you have one string, you have to code or talk about this particular string. On the other hand, we would prefer to talk about an ensemble of strings for two possible reasons. For two reasons. The first reason is if you actually do have one string, right, then there is nothing to learn. If you want to predict the next point in the string, you just look at the data bank and say the next point is this. There is nothing to predict, there is nothing to learn, there is nothing to code. It's one string. On the other hand also, if you want to assign complexity measure to a source based on the string that the source produces, you may have atypical realizations and then you may assign a wrong complexity measure. So you actually want to measure or to average over all possible strings. Even in Kolmogorov approach, the ensemble is implicit. The ensemble in Kolmogorov approach is the biggest possible ensemble of strings that you can create in this alphabet. Right? So that's the ensemble that he discusses, even though it's an implicit thing. So basically what we're saying is that we're always going to look to work with averagings, with ensembles, even though we have just one observation in our hand. And if we don't know what the ensemble is, well, I try to convince you that even if you don't have an ensemble at your disposal, you actually have it implicitly, right? So these are three pictures that I show. They have the same average color, both of these three pictures. So the number of pixels which are black is the same on all three pictures. So now they have exactly the same probability to appear as a random picture taken from some random number generator. However, if I ask you to draw a picture which is similar to this picture, you're not going to draw something random. You're probably going to, unless you actually want to make a joke of me, right? You will probably want to draw something which is periodic, which is regular. If I ask you to draw a picture which is similar to this one, we'll draw something random. So the ensemble that you implicitly have by looking at this picture is an ensemble of random pictures. Here, if I ask you to draw a picture which is similar to this one, well, if you know that this is a picture of my wife, then you'll probably draw another picture of her. If you do not know that this is a picture of my wife, you'll probably draw another face, meaning that your assumptions, actually, your a priori assumptions, influence the what implicit ensembles you may have in your mind. But in both cases, you will have an implicit ensemble, ensemble of pictures of my wife or ensemble of pictures of all people that you've ever seen. But in any cases, you're going to draw a face here. You're not going to draw a cube if I ask you to draw a similar picture. So ensemble is there.
So your now, point is that the Kolmogorov complexity for the two pictures on the two sides.
On all the three pictures is the same. Kolmogorov complexity for all three pictures is the same.
Okay. But I thought Kolmogorov complexity is the length of the rule that.
That's right, right.
But the length of the rule of the two pictures on the side is very simple, but not in the middle.
Pardon?
I thought that.
No, for this one, let's throw away this picture for a second, okay? Because it's a bit more difficult for this one, but just let's look at these two pictures. So the Kolmogorov complexity is the length of the shortest program that can create exactly this same picture, exactly the same picture. So if you want to create exactly this same picture, you will have to describe to me every single point, whether it's black or white.
Right.
If you want to create...
The Kolmogorov complexity for that one is very simple.
It's very simple. This I agree. Right. For these two, it's the same.
So Kolmogorov does distinguish that one, but it doesn't distinguish the one in the middle.
The one in the middle from this one, right.
Probably a little larger than the one in the middle, right? That can be compressed.
The same is probably this one, too. I mean, yes. You will be able to do some kind of compression, but you will not be able to make sort of a qualitative distinction between these two things. I'm probably explicitly trying to be vague here. I don't want to go into the details of the stuff which I don't understand completely myself. So it's a very difficult subject to model of complexity, right? So we have these ensembles there. So the next question which you ask is, which ensemble are you talking about, right? I mean, this implicit ensemble. How do you select these priors? So information theory is intrinsically a Bayesian theory. You must have an ensemble in mind if you want to solve to make the any kind of information calculations. However, in the past year, starting from approximately 1970 by a guy named Schwartz in Hebrew University, and then McKay Balasubramanian, etc., etc. There's a whole bunch of work. People have shown that actually it's not that bad with Bayesian series. So suppose that we have two different ensembles in mind. Ensemble which is given by model family, this is just an example, of course. An ensemble which is given by model family A or model family B. And now I ask you, you know, which of this ensemble did the data come from? Well, you just do Bayesian inference. Probability of ensemble given, of model A, which is this ensemble A, given the data, is just probability of data given the ensemble. Probability of ensemble divided probability, total probability of the data. And then probability of data in this ensemble is probability of data for every parameter which describes this ensemble integrated over all parameters, and probability of data with this parameter, right? So you have this integral where this P, X is actually a very large dimensional object, n-dimensional object. So it's going to be possible in some cases, and actually it turns out in very many cases, to do this integral by saddle point approximation. You do this integral by saddle point approximation and you immediately realize that that's what you get.
If there's a question of rotation, what is the difference in P and PR?
It's an I just wanted to use different notation. So P of X given alpha is probability of X in alpha. PR is a priori probability of the model.
So PR of A is just the same as P of A.
Yes. Yes. I just wanted to have different letters for everything.
Then in that integral, the P of alpha should have a subscript A, right? Obviously.
Obviously. Absolutely. I missed the. This is P of A. I'm sorry. Yes. This is P of A. PA of alpha. So you do this integral on top by saddle point approximation, and there is a whole theory by enlarged by Vapnik and the group on theory of uniform convergence, which shows that in a lot of cases, these integrals actually can be done by saddle point approximations, and the higher order corrections are not important. And what you get is the QA of so this, yeah. Pardon?
Should that be Q or something?
No. I think it's right here. So it's the probability of data in the maximum likelihood parameters in model A, which is the usual measure of goodness of fit, right? And then you get a flotation determinant, which actually enters with a negative sign, right? So if the flotation determinant is very big, which is what happens for very complex models, then the probability that this model actually gave rise to this data, this ensemble gave rise to this data, is very small. So this is just a phase space factor. If this or similar objects have very little probability in this ensemble, this total probability is going to be small. So you have a fight between fluctuations, complexity, generalization error, you can call it in different ways. Usually it's called Occam factor in learning community, and the goodness of fit. And if
this is some kind of steepest descent calculation.
This is exactly saddle point, yes, steepest descent. And the point is that it holds.
QA can be expressed in terms of a lot of P's given, right?
I don't understand the difference between P and Q.
Yeah, Q is derived from the P.
Sorry, this is one of the things which I just messed up because I was trying to bring two talks together. What's Q, right? So Q, P of X given alpha and Q is the same thing. This and this is the same thing. I'm sorry, I was trying to bring two talks together and I didn't notice. And similarly
okay,
here.
P of X given alpha equals QA of X.
Yes. Okay. So sorry, that's... So P of X given alpha is exactly Q of X given alpha.
And same on the bottom, right?
And same on the bottom. I'm really sorry. So the bottom has P of A, PA of X given alpha, and here it's the same PA of X given alpha.
Okay.
Sorry. OQ, whatever. So basically, what you have is you can rather easily, by looking at just one sequence, which ensemble does it have a probability to belong to, and then you average over all possible ensembles, and that's what happens.
Mm-hmm. How do those two terms scale with n? I know you told me.
So this goes linearly with n because it's normally you can create many different situations, and this can go either logarithmically or as a power law or anything but lower orders than linearly in n.
So is that your subextensive?
This is exactly the subextensive term. Actually, it turns out that this is going to be exactly the subextensive term, modulus sum corrections or the one corrections.
So
for some models, again.
So if n goes to infinity, then you can never distinguish between two models.
So if n goes to if n goes to infinity, if you actually have infinite n, then you are always tempted to get a model which has the largest structure. However, if n goes to infinity, what may happen is that this stuff starts not, stops scaling with n. This also can happen if you actually get into the model which describes the data exactly, then it doesn't actually make sense to get larger and larger and larger models. You just describe exactly. So in principle, for all practical purposes, it works. And there are books written on the cases, why it should work and how it should work, so that these two things actually balance each other at the right point. And so our point here was actually to show that the same stuff holds for infinite dimensional distributions, for field theory type models, when you cannot have when you don't have finite number of parameters to describe a model. So, and the finite parameter case was known before.
Okay, so just to understand that, if you have two different models, they both, for reasonable size Android, scale linearly within.
Yes. But yeah, this is typical, yeah.
So you're looking at this difference up here, and this difference now is going to be dominated by the second term. So if you plotted two models, they both dominate.
Yes. So if I plot two models.
The sub-extensive part is actually big compared to this difference.
To this difference. Maybe big compared to this difference, right? Maybe big compared to this difference. Okay. And the point here, again, let's get back to this picture, right? In your mind, you have all three ensembles. You have an ensemble of regular stuff, random stuff, an ensemble of pictures, an ensemble of also pictures of my wife, four ensembles, right? And then you take an average over all possible ensembles, over all possible models, given this data which you've observed, and you immediately see that it's much more probable that this data came from regular pictures, while this one came from random, and this is photos. So even if you do not know ensembles, but you average over a large enough set of ensembles, you can figure out which ensemble is the right one with some high probability. Fine, so I skipped over this part very quick. That's nice. Okay, so how can predictive information behave? So we finished with that part and going to slightly different stuff. Well, as I told you, there are three qualitatively different cases. Of course, there can be some other logarithmic powers of logarithms, et cetera, corrections, but qualitatively, the only three cases are possible are constant, log, and to some power, which is less than one. Why would we not distinguish, let's say, n multiplied by log here, or let's say log squared case? Because again, in my work with modeling, I've never had such a case. It's very difficult to understand what a case, let's say, log squared would mean. It will not correspond to finite parameter models, would correspond to something, to some multifactorial probably model, but it's just, I've never encountered anything like that. So we skip over this part. So the three possible cases are like this. So the first case, as I already told, in the first case you have all simply predictable, periodic, regular, etc. models. You also have fully stochastic or fully Markov models. They're all in the first region, and you can very easily calculate that this is so. I'm not even going to do this kind of calculation. To the second case, you have learning of finite parameter models. And in the learning community, this quantity is actually rather well investigated as the mutual information between the observations and the parameters of the model, not as the predictive information. So they're almost the same, not exactly the same. Finally, the power law case corresponds to, as an example, learning continuous distributions where you do not have a finite parameter model describing these distributions. So what I just want to show is I want to show these two examples to you to show to go through some calculations, probably in 10 minutes or so, just to see how, to show to you how this happens. But these are not by any means the only possible examples. As I already shown, DNAs, text, etc. are all in this family.
Excuse
right?
me, sorry. Mm-hmm. In this field, one thing that confuses me in this subject is that there are all these words that are thrown around very loosely. Not random, loosely. What's the difference between process and density? I mean, in
It's very easy. It's very easy. It's very, I mean, the general thing is you call something a density if it depends only on if it's an identical an IID variable, identical independent identical distributed variable. Then a probability density for this variable you would call a density. If the density for the next something, next object depends on something previous, like which is Markov, then you will call this process. But again, you can write it as a density which has two variables in it. Get density of one given the other.
Oh, so it's also a density.
It's also density, but density which depends on the past. So density which depends on the past, you will call process.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
Okay. So I mean that's. So specific examples which I'm going to show are the examples, these two examples I alluded to, learning finite parameter and infinite parameter models, learning theory. So we have a two probability distribution to observe x given some parameter alpha, which in principle can be finite or infinite dimensional. We discussed both cases. Dimensionality of alpha is k. There is an a priori measure on alphas, and we've already discussed how we can select this stuff. And we get x1 through xn vector variable x's taken from this distribution. Should be vector here. So probability distribution, this is IID, independent identical distributed variables. So probability distribution of all these x's given a parameter is just a product. That's what it means. Then probability of all x's is just integration over all parameters. And then entropy of all of these x's is just integration over x's of p of x log p of x with a negative sign, just by definition. So now I want to calculate this entropy. That's what I want to do. So first what I want to do, I want to split out the extensive piece. How I do this? First, we notice that this p of x has an integral over alphas in it, right? We call this alpha, let's say alpha bar, because there is another alpha integral inside the logarithm. Change the order of integrals of x and alpha, and that's what we get. So we change the order of integrals of x and alpha, and that's what we get. Just some stuff. Then we multiply and divide by, so there is alpha bar integral outside, there is alpha integral inside the logarithm. We multiply and divide by log of q of x given alpha bar inside the integral, right? So what happens here now is a very simple thing. You know, log, of course, you can cut in half. You can have two logs. And the first term, which is going to be integral of something q log q, produces you an extensive term. Here it is, which is just the average entropy over the whole ensemble, the average entropy, the average amount of information that this one point gives to you. Integrate over all possible alphas, over all possible sequences. And then the most important part is what's remaining of S1 of n, right? It's going to be integral over alpha bar, the outside integral, integral over all x's, p of alpha bar, here it is, log of this integral, which now has this energy function in it. I'm trying to make it sort of look like a statistical mechanics problem. This energy function has a quench disorder in it. This is those x's which we have observed, which were averaging over outside the logarithm, right?
Why doesn't this energy function depend on alpha bar? What happens to alpha bar? It's q of alpha divided by
alpha bar x.
It does depend.
It's supposed to be somewhere here. Again, I'm sorry. It does depend on it. It's supposed to be there. So basically, now here it doesn't depend on anything at all, right? So.
Yeah. What is b? 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 The integral on x.
Where?
In S zero, you integrate over x.
Our x is possibly a vector variable, right? So dx is the dimensionality of the vector x.
But it's not n.
It's not n. So basically, you have now a two-dimensional data set. Each x can be multidimensional, then you have many of those x's. So the picture here is actually very interesting, and that's what I'm trying to tell. So this is some energy function which measures, in some sense, the error in your prediction, right? Because this quantity is also, if those familiar, who are familiar, is a Kolbach-Leibler, empirical Kolbach-Leibler divergence, which measures the error between two distributions. So this measures the error in your predictions if, instead of alpha bar, you actually made a guess which is alpha. So you have x's taken from distribution alpha bar, and then you approximate them with alpha, approximate alpha bar with alpha, and this is your error because of such approximation, and then you average over this error. So this S1 is an average error that you would that you will make in this process.
Okay, mm-hmm. I got lost in notation, but S1 should be the difference between the average of the log and log of the average sample.
No. Okay. No. S1 is just precisely how I defined it before. It's a subextensive piece of this S. So S1 is this piece is S0 over here, and this integration is S1. It doesn't have dependence on n. Now, if I want to actually make an calculation of this integral, well, the only way we can do, or at least I can do, calculations for quench systems is to approximate them with annealed approximation, right? So this is our quenched energy, which also depends on alpha bar, as you've noticed. And the annealed energy is actually, as I already told, the Kolbach-Leibler divergence between alpha bar and alpha. Right? So that's what our error in approximation is. That's what the fluctuation is. And if we made the annealed approximation, we now have the annealed partition function. This is annealed free energy, annealed partition function, right? And we averaged it over all the sources of noise, which is in our case now becomes alpha bar. So basically what happens is, again, we are predicting alpha bar with alpha. This is the error that we make. This is the coding length or whatever coding error that you make, e to this stuff. Log of that is the entropic error that you make, and then you average it over alpha. So it's a total entropic error that you make, that you will make in making such a prediction. So the question now is this approximation actually a valid approximation or not? As it turns out, in vast majority of cases, unlike in statistical mechanics, this is a valid approximation. If this approximation is invalid, it actually means that fluctuations, which is, you know, this is a fluctuation, the difference between the actual Kolbach-Leibler distance and the empirical Kolbach-Leibler distance, the fluctuation is large, meaning that you've got an sample from which you cannot learn the underlying parameters, right? So what it means is that if you can learn, it means that annealed approximation and quenched approximation are almost the same. If they're not the same, you just cannot learn something. And the reason for that, why it's so common that these two things are the same, is a very simple reason. So the partition function, the annealed partition function, which I had on the previous page, this one, right? There it is. Oops. Sorry. Okay. Can be written using the just normal density of states, where now the energy is the error you make, the Kolbach-Leibler distance between your true distribution and the guess. And you can write it in exactly the same form as you would actually do it in normal statistical mechanics. And now the key point here is that the density of states integrates to one because of the normalization conditions on all of the distributions involved. Which means that actually you have just one or finite number of guesses that you can make if everything is. So you cannot be too far away from the actual distribution. You are always very close to it. There is just one or finite number of guesses, depending on how you define normalization. And that's the reason why the annealed approximation is very close normally to the quenched result. And so depending on this partition function, you will get different subextensive terms. Depending on the density of states, you will get different subextensive terms. So if density of states, which is how many models do you have in the vicinity of a given model, which are d away from this model, so which gives you D error from this model. If it scales as a power law in normal statistical mechanics way, then you get predictive information as one. S1 is d over 2 log n, right? And this is an example of this is finite parameter learning, where you can rewrite Kolbach-Leibert divergence in a very simple form using Fisher information, and the result follows in 2 minutes.
So temperature is something like 1 over n?
1 over n, exactly. I think I wrote it down, but I didn't tell it. Yeah, it's a linear decrease in temperature. Temperature is 1 over n. So the temperature just falls down, and you are new before that. Another example, a very beautiful example of this case, is actually Markov process, Markov chain. So here in Markov chain, you realize that correlations between points are not only because you have parameters in this process, but because points are just intrinsically correlated. What happens next depends on what happened in the future. There are two possible correlations. In many cases, it may happen that therefore, the extensive term, which just measures the intrinsic correlations, will have a power law or a logarithmic correction. And then the predictive information will include this term. So there is no way to distinguish between intrinsic correlations and correlations due to knowledge of parameters. And this is actually very clear that it should be this way if you look from statistical mechanics perspective. In statistical mechanics, for example, you can describe the same system as a system of let's say spins, which are local, which interact with each other, and the only predictability from one spin to the next is because they have interactions. Or on the other hand, you can say that we may have a mean field, or in some cases you can say that we have mean field, and both descriptions are equivalent. So learning the value of the mean field, which carries predictive information, predictability from one point to the other, is the same as learning the probability distribution of two spins. You cannot distinguish parameter, the external field which you are trying to learn, from the intrinsic interactions between things. So it's actually very nice that it happens this way. So what can happen is also that, instead of the powerless singularity, you may have an essential singularity, it's essential zero in the density function. And then you will immediately see that depending on how essential this singularity is, you will get different power law behaviors of predictive information. They're always less than one, which is very nice. And the stronger singularity, which is the smaller amount of modules are in the vicinity of the model that you've chosen, the larger is the predictive information. The smaller amount of modules, the more you gain by selecting one particular model. And the example of this paper by Galik, Cullen, and Strawn in 96, where they discussed learning of not a parametric distribution, but learning of just a distribution given by a function, phi of x, e to the minus phi of x is a distribution. And then if you want to learn it, you need to put some kind of constraints on top of that, continuity constraints, which are given by a normal kinetic term for the field theory with the normalization factor. You do the calculations, and you immediately see that the density of states is an essential singularity, and the predictive information is a power law. And this was, as far as I understand, the first example in the literature that you can actually get predictive information which grows as a power law. Now we come to the last point of the talk, so I will even finish probably in time. So far, I've just described learning through predictability. So how does it relate to complexity? First, again, which kind of complexity are we talking about? We've said it already many times here. This has to be a complexity of dynamics that is generated by time series, right? Dynamics which generates totally random stuff and dynamics which generates totally predictable stuff is in both cases very simple. It should be very simple complexity. This complexity should be usable for Occam-style punishments, which I've shown to you, which help you to select the correct model. This complexity must be expressible in normal physical terms, like entropy, energy, temperature, etc., etc. Otherwise, it just, there is no way we are going to be able to calculate it from normal physics. Finally, as we already discussed, it has to be attached to an ensemble, not to a single realization. So how do we do this? So this is what we want to have from complexity. How do we define it? First, we know that all the same axioms that Shannon has used to define entropy actually are very reasonable axioms to define complexity. Complexity of two sources has to be, you know, an addition of complexities, sum of complexities of both of the sources. It has to be continuous in all of the parameters of the sources. It has to, you know, if you have either source A with some probability or source B with some probability, complexity should add up with the same probabilities. It's all very meaningful. So what it means is that if we're going to measure complexity, it's going to be some kind of entropy. Unfortunately, if we're talking about a source which has past and future and parameters and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there are infinite ways you can write entropies. You can write entropy of past conditional on future, entropy of future conditional on past, entropy of both of them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So pretty much it doesn't solve the problem yet. There are many complexities, many entropies you can write for such a source. So we have to limit our choice down, right? What we do is we say that we make this for the following observation. If you, let's say, read a newspaper, and newspaper has a misprint, well, it's a local misprint, you don't care about it. You can always restore the word. If it says cat instead of cut, by reading the sentence, you will be able to restore the correct spelling. And the complexity, the dynamics doesn't change because of that. This is the same newspaper article written by the same author about the same events, published in the same newspaper. What happened is just local error. So what we're saying is that we do not care about local transformations of the signal. Complexity should be something that is insensitive to local transformations of the signal. You can also see it in the example of languages that Tony has mentioned, right? Complexity of Grimm's fairy tales is the same whether it's in English or in German. This is the same Brothers Grimm who wrote about the same events or whatever, same fictional events. The only stuff which is different is the language in which it's written. But language translation from one language to the other is a totally local thing. You translate word by word, if not letter by letter, right? Like most sentence by sentence. So complexity must be insensitive to this local transformations. So the next axiom which we put is precisely this axiom, that if a probability for some chain X, it has to be capital X, and I apologize for this, which is the whole chain, the whole X1, X2, X3, etc., etc., is changed to a probability, is equal to some other probability plus local operators in the same sense as we use them in this term in normal physics, then the complexity of both processes has to be the same. So if one process can be obtained from the other by just local transformations, it has to be the same. And then of all the possible entropies which were still left after the first step, the only piece which remains is the divergent subextensive term of predictive information. So it's the first subextensive term of entropy of a source. The extensive piece changes when you do let's say translations, as I also told to Tony, entropy of English and German is different. The non-divergent subextensive pieces change when you make a single mistake in some word in the orthographical, you know, in the spelling of some one word. But the subextensive term, which measures complexity or meaning or structure, does not change under this type of transformations. The point here is actually very, and that immediately explains why we talk about always about one-dimensional time. Well, in principle, let's say suppose you are at CERN and you have a detector of an elementary particle detector which has 10 million different sub-detectors in it, right? And then you observe for time t, which is also 10 million instances of time. It doesn't actually make sense to talk about this as a one-dimensional vector in time. As a million-dimensional vector going in time. Actually, what you have here is a two-dimensional source where you get data both in space and in time, right? The same happens with your retina. You get data in space and in time. However, local operators in more than one dimensions can produce long-range interactions, long-range correlations. So it would be a bit too cavalier to just throw them away. You would throw away some kind of long-range interactions, long interactions if you just require this stuff. And unfortunately, we are not yet able to provide a similar axiom that would work in higher number of dimensions. So we're always therefore talking about low-dimensional, one-dimensional objects. So this defines the complexity measure. I'll skip through this. Basically, we can show that it relates to every possible complexity, even to Kolmogorov complexity, which is one-string complexity, as I explained in the beginning. And now the last slide. So what should we do next with this stuff? So we defined it. What do we do next? The stuff which we actually worked most on and which is hopefully going to be completed within the next few months, years, I don't know, is how do you actually separate predictive information from non-predictive in the real data? And for this, there is work by Tali Tishbich and Bill, which he gave a talk here on separating relevant information some time ago, and we're working along those lines, and I think we're rather successful so far. The next thing is, we've used some physical intuition here, so maybe we should actually now go from this complexity of learning language back to physics and see what we can do in physics with this kind of ideas. And as I already mentioned in this example of translating knowledge from just interactions between local spins and global order parameters, well, it may be that you can classify phase transitions and learn order parameters which are the objects that carry information around in the systems using this type of approach. You just sit down, calculate predictive information and see what is in front of this log n term. And whatever is in front of the log n term is what you should call the order parameter, because that's what carries predictive information around. If it's zero, there is no predictability. If it's non-zero, there is predictability in the system. Another thing which I'm working on is that apparently there is some very straightforward relation to non-extensive statistical mechanics, which was proposed by Thales some 13 years ago, which you can actually you can show that statistical mechanics, non-extensive statistical mechanics, is actually the same statistical mechanics, but when the subextensive piece of the entropy is not negligibly small. So these two things are not as this is not new physics, but just a new understanding of the same old physics. Then the most important stuff, which I hoped I would talk about that one today, but when the talk got announced over the whole list, I decided to skip mostly, is the reflections to biology and all of the experiment that we are looking for and trying to do to see whether this general principle that the animal behavior is governed by trying to extract as much useful information versus just extracting information outside from the outside world, that this is actually the guiding principle of animal behavior. And there are some experiments which can be used to talk about this, at least. Maybe not make statements, not make results, but talk about this. And I guess I should stop here because I didn't talk about other types of things so far. So that's it.